All right, the committee will come to order. Reverend Kelly, would you move the minutes from the February 17th meeting?
Yes, sir.
All right, any questions on those? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? The minutes are adopted. Representative Hosh. I will move that House File 120 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. And is there amendment as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair, there is amendment on the A09 amendment.
The A09-0028, that one? Yeah,
correct.
Okay. I will move that as well. That's just to get the bill in the order you want it to be in?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right, any questions? All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hosh.
Mr. Chair and committee members, due to brevity and the need to get to another bill, I believe, with the committee, I just want to thank you for your time and hand it over to the testifiers from the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Hatch, and I'm an attorney who represents the Healthcare Cooperative. With me is Mr. Charles Neff, who is the CEO of the Healthcare Cooperative. And Alan Ross is a physician in Ortonville, Minnesota. And the Healthcare Cooperative was started in 1995 for pursuant to the Minnesota healthcare changes in the healthcare laws of the state. And it essentially allows small town physicians and some of the smaller hospitals to get together and give assistance in terms of how they deliver services. There was a complaint. It was passed by statute. It says that they're supposed to be regulated by the Department of Health. They have a contract. It's supposed to be approved by the Department of Health. They filed it in the Department of Health. We don't think we need to look at it. And things went along very fine for 10 years. They're still operating and everything is going well. Other than the fact they're having a darn tough time getting physicians in greater Minnesota. You know, there was an article just a couple of weeks ago about the lack of psychiatric help out there. And one of the problems, which Dr. Ross will tell you, is that they, Dr. Paul, it's very difficult to set up a practice and have to do all of the administrative work involved in conducting a medical practice. And in the case of Dr. Ross, he works with four other doctors, and it's still extraordinarily difficult to do. The Minnesota Healthcare Cooperative operates throughout western Minnesota and southwestern Minnesota. It's a number of smaller hospitals, a number of smaller clinics. They negotiate with about 20% of the market. Most of the market in rural Minnesota is Medicare, Medicaid, and Blue Cross Blue Shield, none of which deal with this cooperative. So it's a very small, tiny bit of assistance that's given. It's been operating fine. All of a sudden, the Federal Trade Commission says, in Washington yet, saying it's fine to have Northwest merge with Delta, but we got to look at these rural physicians. And so they've expended extraordinary fees on lawyers in Washington. And everything seems to be going well because they say, well, folks, if you go and get a bill saying that you can be regulated by the Department of Health, we'll let it go. And as you'll see on the handout, in terms of the market share, look at Exhibit 3, less than 20% market share is affected by the people here, small. Exhibit 4 are some of the projects that this co-op has done with regard to diabetes, part of vascular disease, preventative services. Exhibit 6 is the bill that passed in 1995, which we assumed already addressed this issue. Exhibit 7 is a letter from the Department of Health saying we don't know if we should be regulating you. Exhibit 8 is a release from the Department of Justice that occurred in Vermont. And once again, the FCC said, go get yourself regulated and then we'll let you alone. It's called the state action doctrine under the antitrust laws. And so Vermont passed the bill and the Department of Justice said we're not going to go further with it. This bill passed last year as an amendment to a different bill. The bill was vetoed, not because of this amendment, but because of a different provision regarding the county purchasing plan. Exhibit 9 is Governor Swinney's veto message, which refers, does not make any adverse comments with regard to this amendment. Exhibits 10 through 20 are letters of support from members of Congress, from the Attorney General, from state senators, state house members, mayors, city council people throughout this rural area. And Exhibit 21 is a copy of an article regarding the lack, the inability to get, for instance, in this case, psychiatric help, but also applies to all types of medical health care in rural Minnesota. For that, Dr. Ross is a physician and can, I think, explain what the difficulties are and how this is of assistance.
Well, thanks for letting me talk to you this afternoon. As Mr. Hatch mentioned, that I'm part of a five-physician group in Ortonville, and we've had a physician shortage. For the last 2 years, we've been recruiting for a physician, and we've had one person come look at our facility, and we've conducted one telephone interview. The co-op offers a lot of efficiencies for us as far as contracting that I don't have to have staff spend time on. And I think most importantly why I'm here today is that I want to be an advocate for my patients. And what I mean by that is back in the mid-1990s, we had health partners patients, not that I'm not critical of health partners, but I'm just using this as an illustration, health partners in our community, we could not get a contract with health partners until we were able to negotiate a contract through the health co-op. And without the co-op, those people in my community would not be able to come and see me at their local clinic. And they might have to travel at that point in time back in the mid-1990s, the closest facility was Wilmer, and they'd have to travel over an hour distance to see a provider. And so that's the main reason why I'm here today. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, be very quick about it. This is probably the only time we've ever had people come in and ask to be regulated by a state agency, and that's what they're asking for.
And Representative Hotz, you this amendment you had talked over with the health department, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This amendment was drafted in cooperation with the health department. The health department is not taking a position for or against. It is completely revenue neutral. The Rural Health Cooperative will pay for all costs, and the Department of Health is acceptable with the language in front of us.
So this suits the health department's needs if this bill is to pass?
Mr. Chair, committee members, yes.
Any questions, members? Okay, thank you. I think Mr. Griffin. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the 8 nonprofit health plans in Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, members, we appreciate the opportunity to testify today on behalf of the Council in opposition to House File 120. I'd like to begin by thanking Representative Hoch for his willingness to work with the Council on this bill during our discussions and correspondence. He's been very gracious with his time, and we appreciate it. He sat down to discuss this bill with us and has been willing to consider some of the ideas we have for amending the bill. While we continue to have differences on the bill, we are committed to working with him as this matter moves forward. House File 120 would provide antitrust immunity to 23 hospitals and 34 clinics so they can collude to set prices for their health care services. To gain immunity from federal antitrust laws, a state must provide the entity seeking immunity with two things. The first is state interest. Passing this bill would give the proponents a state interest. The second thing that they need is sufficient state involvement. The portion of the bill requiring the allowance of a commissioner to become involved in this process is an attempt to show sufficient state interest. We do not believe that this permissive review is enough to meet the standard of sufficient state interest. We've sought to learn about the problems that this bill is attempting to solve. We've been told that the Federal Trade Commission has been investigating the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative about alleged collusion in the marketplace. This bill seems to us to be an attempt to legalize that activity for this group of providers. In our view, this bill will legalize collusion, which occurs when two or more competitors agree to change the bids that they otherwise would have in offer of the absence of the agreement. If passed, this bill would have an effect on the total health care cost prices across the health care system. This will result in larger increases in health care premiums paid by small employers and individuals. The bill does nothing to improve quality of care provided or to create a better value for consumers. Antitrust laws are an important competitive policy instrument that underlie our public policies supporting the marketplace. The idea of a free market is to make markets operate more competitively to benefit consumers. Over 100 years ago, antitrust laws were enacted to combat anti-competitive practices and to reduce market domination by a few and preserve the unfettered competition at the rule of trade. Antitrust laws prohibit price fixing, geographic dividing of markets, and other activities that artificially set the price of goods or services at a certain level or place, contrary to the workings of a free market. Mr. Chairman, members, the Minnesota Council of Health Plan opposes the bill because it would give these providers an unfair advantage in negotiating rates for the community served. The result would be the increased cost on small employers and individuals who purchase health care coverage. We have provided representatives with an amendment which we believe would hold those prices down. For the reasons above stated, Mr. Chairman, members, we would oppose the bill and urge you to reject it. If there are questions, we'd be happy to take them at this time.
Representative Abler has a question.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate the big forum. I have a concern about this. I realize you're in a serious role, but how many lives are covered by these cooperatives, do you think?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Griffin, Representative Abler, I do not know. They are not huge groups, and I have not said this in my testimony, but Mr. Chairman, my clients contract with the Rural Health Cooperative. I think we have a good relationship in having worked with them in the past, but that does not mean that we believe that they ought to be exempt from antitrust law.
Yeah, just maybe at some point you can come back and it'd be interesting to see, just to hear a response. Maybe I'll just, if you could let the word collusion. I mean, I know you pretty well, but I realize you're concerned about this. But the word collusion is a strong word to use. And if you have a bunch of little people, it's hard to imagine them really colluding with any bad impact. But
we'll hold that question. Yeah, well, we can ask that question as well.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could, Representative Abler. This is a small group of providers right now. There's nothing in this legislation that doesn't say other providers can't join this group. And I assume if you give antitrust immunity to a group of providers, there are going to be a lot of people that would like to have that. We had some very, very strong litigation in the state less than 20 years ago by the Attorney General's office in which there were agreements that were entered into for multi-tens of millions of dollars because of price fixing that had gone on in attempts to try and box out competition and around Minnesota, and we'd be happy to share those examples with you if the legislation moves forward. We take this very seriously, Mr. Chairman. I don't use those words lightly.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Griffin, what's the difference between this group if all these individual practices and hospitals were bought by the Sanford system, which is in the process of doing that all over that part of the state? Why is that any different?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, that's what the law makes as a difference. If you decide to merge and these groups can do that, or they can be bought by somebody else, then they are a part of the same group. Would it make it more difficult for us to contract with them, and would they have a stronger market share? Yes, that's part of the market. But we don't tell the individuals that they can get together and set prices and things if they are separate organizations.
You done? Okay. You mentioned that this is permissive language. The way I read it, they have to actually review the application.
Mr. Chairman?
I just see a shell there. Maybe I'm not reading it correctly, but...
Mr. Chairman, as I read the language, I know we have an amendment to the language that just went on. The language said, as I read the bill, that the commissioner had 60 days to review it, but if the commissioner did not review it, it was automatically approved. That to us is permissive review. It doesn't require mandatory review.
Okay. Well, and that's just to keep the commissioner on his toes. Or her toes in this case, I guess.
Yeah.
And the other question I guess I had was, the point that was raised here about this small clinic not being able to contract with health plans. And in some sense, I think one of the problems may be, that 80% of the market is taken up in what? Medicare, Medicaid, and Blue Cross. Sounds somewhat monopolistic to me in some sense. And then that other 20%, the health plans are larger entities than these small clinics. And so I think one of the things here is that maybe to try to bring some balance to that. And I don't know if this strikes the right balance, but any reaction to that kind of concept?
Mr. Chairman, I have a strong reaction to that concept.
I'm sure you do.
Mr. Chairman, members, I think it's often viewed as the health plans come out and say, take it or leave it, and that's all you have. And I would look at this from a little different angle, which is from the angle of somebody coming from our plans going out and trying to contract in an area. where there is only one group of providers. And that's not just true in the rural area. It's very true here in the metro area when we sit down and try and talk with a group of specialists, and there's only one specialty organization that covers half of the metro area and one that covers the other half of the metro area, and we're in a take-it-or-leave-it position. And you see the results of those negotiations when you look at healthcare premiums, which are going up dramatically because those providers have monopolistic ability, because they've merged together, because they have worked together to really dictate what the prices will be. And that's even a stronger concern when you get to upstate Minnesota, where there aren't a large number of providers. This group of providers, Mr. Chairman, is a very different group of providers than trying to deal with some of the big organizations, and Representative Huntley pointed out the concerns that exist with those organizations. But we try and work with them, not just exempt them from the laws.
Okay. Representative Ava had a question. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Griffin?
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. There's a question about the number of lives covered, and also if you have other questions, Representative Ava.
Well, they might just want to offer a thought. And if, you know, Mr. Griffin wants, it's actually good to have a dialogue sometimes. So, but if they, I'm sure they want to react to that term, and I respect how he meant it. So.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, the probably less than 40,000 people are affected in this. There's probably 200,000 people in the market place in western, southwestern Minnesota, but almost all of them are in Medicare, Medicaid, or Blue Cross Blue Shield. So we're talking about a very tiny portion. This bill, by the way, I find it somewhat bordering on the word chutzpah for the Minnesota health plans, which is a combination of a very few strong monopolistic HMOs, to sit here and cry about a couple of rural doctors who can't figure out how to read one of these contracts, nor should they have to. What they want to do is treat patients. The idea that somehow this is permissive regulation is preposterous, because this is the same regulation that the HMOs and insurance companies work under, and it's called the Deamer language. If you don't prove it or disapprove it in 60 days, it's deemed approved. The reason why we have Deamer language is that for years, regulators wouldn't move on things. So basically what the legislature did here and in other states is say, listen, move on it, make a decision, you got 60 days to do it. That's not permissive. That's the same. It basically puts the burden on the regulator to move ahead. And if there were, if these people were raising rates, I can assure you, you'd see a lawsuit in a minute. The FTC is looking at it as a technicality more than anything. They basically said, get the bill through, and we can go away. And that's essentially the proposal here. I do a lot of work in the healthcare area, and I can tell you the lowest paid medical providers in Minnesota, I know this firsthand, are people in western Minnesota. This is simply to facilitate their ability to exist.
And one other question, I mean, there's the negotiations with the health plans, but there's also an issue, and I think this was, as I understand it, what was driving this initially, is also negotiations with on the purchasing side. I mean, is that piece of it as well?
If I could clarify, as far as us doing group purchasing, is that part of it? We do some other things, too, in addition to contracting. We do a couple things that are kind of part of the contracting effort that is really the benefit goes to the health plan, which we do delegated credentialing, which we take on the credentialing burden, saving them time and effort and so forth. We do all the legwork, all the verifications, and we tell them if somebody's passed and document it. And then the other thing we do is we do site visits, which go out to the various sites every 2 years. And then we do joint quality projects. And, you know, when a couple of years back, quality still is a big issue, but the health plans were really aggressive wanting to have two quality projects per health plan. Well, our members, very few of which have electronic health records, would have had to do, you know, up to, 16 quality projects. It just wouldn't happen. So what we do is we do two or three more robust quality projects. We assist them in doing it and compile the report and get that to the health plan. So, and we also act as a liaison for problems, or kind of a help desk for both the health plans and for our members. Really, when it comes down to our negotiating here, too, one thing I wanted to say is we provide economies of scale, or I should say critical mass, making it worth the health plan's while to even bother. Dr. Ross pointed out very clearly, when we were first started, a lot of health plans wouldn't even bother. Some of the health plans that are apparently against us now, we help them get into the market against Blue Cross. So it's interesting how times change. The other thing I want to mention is we're doing one of our biggest projects, which is going to end up dwarfing the rest of our business, is we're doing a shared health information technology project. We got a $500,000 Minnesota eHealth Initiative grant. We're working on a rural health clinic grant or hospital grant for $125,000. Got a $50,000 Blandon grant. We got $20,000 from UCARE to help us with this, $30,000 from Prime West. Right, the initial group is five hospitals going together to do a shared HIT system, with a professional data center based somewhere maybe in the metro, a quality data center with redundancies and disaster recovery. So, long story short, we do as much as we can to add value to our members. And contracting is just one of the pieces.
Thank you. Representative Huntley has one last question. Then
okay. I was just going to comment on that health information. There's also a lot of money in the stimulus bill.
We'll be there.
Any other questions, members? All right. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 120 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor of that say aye.
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 All opposed? Motion bail.
Thank you.
Have fun. All right. Representative Rukavina. Welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 292 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Is that the right referral?
I believe so, Mr. Okay. Chair, and I do have an amendment, so I believe that's in your possession. It's you.
Yep, it's the A1 amendment, and I will move the A1 amendment as well to put the bill in the form the author would like it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I don't often come in front of the Health and Human Service Committee, but I'm here today. I'm pleased to be here, actually. And let me tell you, when I was asked to carry this bill, I was a little reluctant, to say the least. And then I thought about, the last 6 years of my life, and my father died 6 years ago. In fact, my father's birthday is today, so I hope that's a good sign that you'll give me a good birthday present here. But my father, at the end of his life, was, I think, taking 13 different prescription drugs, had diabetes, high blood pressure. My mother, who passed away this June, was in a nursing home for 3 years with Parkinson's disease that got progressively worse, and it was hard to walk, and she had glaucoma. And when some of the folks came to me with their stories of their loved ones, I decided that I'd carry the bill. Members, I'm just going to give you a brief overview of the bill quickly. The bill, of course, allows for medical marijuana use, allows up to 2.5 ounces or 12 plants under certain conditions. The Commissioner of Health monitors all of this. The bill describes many of the medical conditions and debilitating diseases that would qualify a patient for being able to apply for medical marijuana use. The doctors and physicians assistants and advanced practice registered nurses are spelled out in the bill as the practitioners. There is written certification by those practitioners as to the fact that the benefits of marijuana would likely outweigh the health risk for the patient, and it requires annual certification by that practitioner. Anytime there's a change in notification, qualifying patients, they have to notify the commissioner within 10 days of any patient's personal information and changes. It requires the Commissioner of Health to provide an annual report to the legislature as to the number of applicants who are applying and how many have been approved and revoked and the nature of their medical condition. There's a number of penalties, and I think you know, a lot of supervision on this bill in an attempt to meet some of the concerns that were expressed last year about this bill by law enforcement and prosecuting attorneys. It provides that the felony to knowingly submit false records or documentation required by the Commissioner of Health for certification for the organizations. It provides sentences, imprisonment up to 5 years or $10,000. There's criminal background checks for primary caregivers in the bill. It's a gross misdemeanor to provide law enforcement fraudulent representation of facts or circumstances related to the medical use of marijuana. It's a felony for qualifying patients to sell or transfer a loan or otherwise give another person their registration card, or to sell, transfer, loan, or otherwise give another person marijuana obtained under this act. So members, there's also, you know, restrictions on those organizations. It requires them to be non-profits for growth of medical marijuana. And finally, there's background checks for those organizations for their employees and board members and everyone else that is involved in this. And members, I did delete in that amendment the appropriation in the bill because we're not sure about the cost, and I'm trying, if there would be any, I think it actually wouldn't cost anything, but I'm trying to get that information. I believe Representative Huntley is trying to help me get that information from the Commissioner of Health. So, members, you know, there's 13 other states that now allow the use of medical marijuana, and in an October 2005 Gallup poll, nationally there's 78% support for this bill. In fact, there's widespread support all over the country, and here in Minnesota, I believe during the last election, one of the local TV stations did basically a push poll in opposition of this bill, and it came out that 60% of the Minnesota public supported it. In that poll, this bill is supported by the American Nurses Association, the Minnesota Nurses Association, the American College of Physicians, the Minnesota Senior Federation. There are a lot of groups nationally, the Lymphoma Foundation of America, the American Academy of HIV Medicine, American Public Health Association. Nine of the states that have allowed medical marijuana use did it by a ballot initiative. And again, overwhelming support. In fact, in the last election in Michigan, it was 63% vote of support for it in every single county in Michigan. It carried. In fact, I think President Obama got 57% of the votes in Michigan compared to this bill. To me, this bill is about compassion, inexpensive treatment for terminally and seriously ill patients. It's about a decision between a physician and his or her patient. People who are sick, members, and at the end of their lives, or who have battled with a debilitating disease and gotten no relief for their pain by any pharmaceutical drugs, I think deserve this bill. And members, you will hear some real life stories. I have, I think, three folks who are going to testify on behalf of this bill. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll just
we have a
quit talking, and if you've got any questions for later, but
we have one change we need to make the amendment. Correction we need to make the amendment, Ms. Hayes.
Mr. Chair, if Representative Rukavina's intent is to delete the appropriation section on the A1 amendment, we need to make a change on line 1.12. Instead of it reading delete section 11, it needs to state delete section 10.
Right, it should be section 10. So, members, I guess I will offer an amendment to the bill, but on the A1 amendment that I'm...
Maybe I also... I think I did want the effective date change, but if we could just wait on that, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Okay, that's fine. Sure. All right, we'll have the testifiers come down. And members, just as the first testifiers want to come down to the table, We are going to focus, this bill is going to go to a lot of committees, so we are really going to try to keep as far as possible our focus on the health care aspects of this bill, as opposed to perhaps the criminal justice and those kind of aspects of this bill. So, you know, there'll be some latitude here, but try to follow those guidelines as far as we can. And we're going to try to keep the testers, if you can, to 2 or 3 minutes, just so we can get through everybody and also have a good discussion of the bill. Welcome to the committee. Is Dr. Wagoner going to go first? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm George Wagoner. I'm a graduate of the University of Michigan Medical School. I'm a board-certified obstetrician-gynecologist and fellow of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. I practiced obstetrics and gynecology for 30 years, the first year here in Virginia, Minnesota, for the rest in Michigan. Until 2 years ago, I had zero experience or even understanding of marijuana. I had a difficult day yesterday. Representative Rukavina spoke of an anniversary of his father's birthday. Oops. 59th anniversary of our first date. My wife of 51 years was diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian carcinoma in early February of 2007. Her most distressing symptom was nausea and vomiting with each course of chemotherapy. Her nausea was only slightly diminished with the usual anti-emetic treatments and medications prescribed by her oncologist. She tried them all. I'd heard anecdotally for years that marijuana was singularly effective for the nausea associated with chemotherapy. Consequently, we consulted our family physician. He said he couldn't prescribe marijuana, but could give her a prescription for Marinol, synthetic THC, one of 60 chemical compounds that can be isolated from marijuana. I had the prescription filled and my wife took the pills. Her nausea was slightly relieved. She still couldn't eat or drink. Slightly relieved after the first pill. After the second pill, she had very disturbing hallucination. She saw a severed head outside our dining room window. And she realized that she was hallucinating and refused to take any more of that medication. It incidentally didn't relieve her symptoms enough for her to eat. In desperation, I told all my acquaintances that if I could obtain some marijuana, we'd like to try it. A Ziploc bag containing a small amount of marijuana mysteriously appeared in my kitchen the next day. I don't know how it got there. It was Sunday and we didn't know how to use it. I tried making marijuana tea. It stayed down about 2 minutes, and she threw it up. She couldn't eat anything like a brownie. I hear that works. You can eat a brownie. Bake it in a brownie. And I was unable to find a pipe for sale in my small town, so I made one out of scraps in my workshop. Put a pinch of marijuana in this pipe, this homemade pipe, and I lit it, and she took 2 breaths of marijuana smoke. Her symptoms, she said, I feel fine. And she ate lunch for the first time in 4 days. Eating lunch isn't a big deal. We all just did it. But when you can't, it's pretty awful. My wife was a non-smoker, and we found later that we could use a Vicks inhaler and put marijuana in on a piece of gauze, and the inhaler in the hot steam released enough of the 60 compounds to do the same thing that the smoke did, and it was much more acceptable to her. It gave her 4 to 6 hours of relief at a time. The relief produced by this medicine was as complete, prompt, and dramatic as any I've seen in 30 years of practice of medicine. The benefits of medicinal use of marijuana are well documented. Last November, my home state of Michigan became the 13th state to approve the medical use of marijuana. Physicians should be able to write a prescription for marijuana, and pharmacists ought to be able to fill it. But until federal law changes to allow such a system, the medical marijuana, the marijuana bill that appears before you, much like the popular laws now working well in 13 states, is the best alternative. Patients should be able to choose the medicine that works best for them with a recommendation of their doctor, without fear of arrest or jail. And that's precisely what this bill will allow.
Thank you, doctor. Any questions, members? Okay. Thank you for testifying. The next... Joni Whiting, Whitting? Whichever order you want to go in.
Okay.
Just please identify yourself for the record if you could.
Okay. Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Rippentrop, and I appreciate the opportunity to submit my testimony in support of the medical marijuana bill today. It's only been 8 months, so still kind of hard. My mom, Jane Schmidt, was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer in November of 2003 and was given about 1 year to live. Mom went through many surgeries and many hospitals. She had a section of her colon removed and then the right half of her liver. A year later, they removed more of her liver and later part of her lung, part of her diaphragm, and a large glob of cancer that had wrapped around her main blood vessel that fed her lower torso. She also caught MRSA, a flesh-eating virus, while in the hospital, and recovering from each surgery became more complicated. Mom tolerated the first full series of chemo quite well. However, the pills she was prescribed for the vomiting cost went up $100 each. They were only about 75% effective, and they took 30 minutes to start working and were not covered by insurance. And they did nothing at all for dwindling appetite. Another surgery and a second series of chemo took its toll. Mom was withering away to nothing with no appetite, and she suffered serious stomach sickness and found it extremely hard to stay in a positive frame of mind. That's when a friend of my dad suggested he buy a bag of marijuana. My dad is a recovering alcoholic and drug user, 30 years clean, and was highly reluctant to bring an illegal substance into the house. But after watching Mom suffer for another few days, he had his friend procure some. My family will tell you that the only miracle drug for cancer is marijuana. two puffs, 2 minutes, and the violent sickness is totally gone. An hour later, my mom was able to have a good meal. The stomach problems from the chemo were totally gone. It also helped her regain a quality of life that allowed her to continue to fight. Unless you're dying yourself, or very close to someone that is, it's extremely hard to imagine how depressing a debilitating illness can be. Dying is bad, but dying in sickness and pain is much worse. My mom ended up living for 4.5 years. She would never have survived the second year without medical marijuana. With it, she is able to keep fighting, was able to travel overseas before the end. In the 12 months before she died, she visited Israel, Jordan, Egypt, Mexico, Cuba, and Greece. These were all lifelong dreams that she was able to fulfill only because of medical marijuana. My father will tell you how ironic it is that the government should worry that a murderer might feel some pain, yet make the only good cancer drug against the law. He likes to say that when they or their spouse or their child has cancer, those that are so against it will become believers in a real hurry. When a loved one is suffering, you do whatever you can do to ease their pain. There's simply no reason that this safe, effective medicine should not be available to those that need it. I strongly urge the committee to support this compassionate legislation.
Thank you. Questions, Summer? Whoever wishes to go next.
Oh, okay. Hello.
Welcome to the committee.
I think we're readjusting here.
And please identify yourself for the record.
Yep.
You would. Thanks.
My name is K.K. Forrest. I'm from Ely, Minnesota. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I am here in support of HF 292. Drove down from Ely yesterday to speak with you, so I'm very, very grateful for a few minutes of your time.
Oh, thank you.
I brought props. Actually.
No, I'm just going to put it up for a second. The
pills in the bag that you look at are just the prescription ones, and actually they don't include all the prescriptions. They don't include things like fentanyl patches. A little bit about myself. First and foremost, I'm a born-again Christian. I went to Chapel Hill Academy for 3 years. In high school, I went to Carson Long Military Institute in New Bloomfield, Pennsylvania, and then came back and graduated from high school in Bloomington and left for the Army basic training 12 days after graduation, where I served our country doing border reconnaissance on the East German and Czechoslovakian borders back when we had communism. The last thing I ever thought I would be doing in my life would be sitting here in front of you talking about how important medical marijuana is. In 2001, I started a career as a photographer. I lived down here. I was working at Three Rivers Park District, 24 parks. I'm sure many of you know it. After 2 years of that, I got married and moved up to northern Minnesota with my wife. Life was going great. I started doing photography for weddings. I was making quite a bit of money. She was working for Northwest Airlines. We were looking forward to all the travel benefits and using the photography to go around with us and see all the amazing things that we have in this country. Life was more than great. I had just finished my first book. It was May 18th, 2004. I was driving down to meet with my publisher. Stayed at his house that night, woke up the next morning in the worst pain of my entire life. I wanted to die at that point. I was admitted into Fairview Southdale Hospital. They did surgery that kept me there for 10 days. A disc had burst in my neck. Found out later, though, that the problem had been that when it burst, it did permanent damage to the spinal cord. So I've had more surgery, and I've got more surgeries coming up. They can't do a whole lot right now. They keep me sitting. I have very low quality of life. My wife, now is my ex-wife, she saw my body deteriorate. She saw me go from doctor to doctor, trying everything. You can see the meds. And that's, these are over the counter. And that's what the doctors are able to prescribe. Don't help us out the way we need to. After the second surgery, the doctors sent me down to the Mayo Clinic. I spent a couple of weeks down there. You're excited when you go to the Mayo Clinic. You're expecting that they're brilliant. They're going to be able to give you back your life. And after 2 weeks there, I remember us crying all the way home. They said that they can't fix everything. But down the road, there's things that are, you know, there'll be techniques that will continue to help out. I've been on meds like morphine, MS Cotton, Percocet, Clonopin, Neurontin, Methadone, Fentanyl. Four of those meds, a doctor can't even call in a prescription. It has to be sent. The side effects are ungodly. The nausea from the fentanyl would make me throw up violently every day. Summers were worse. I would typically, the last few years, would lose up to 30 pounds each summer from vomiting. Never sleep. The pain was too overwhelming. You would flip-flop, and my arm would never rest. I would spend 21 to 22 hours a day in bed. It's been 5 years. The doctor still did not let me do physical therapy. It just drugged me and weight and makes me wait. I used medical marijuana for up and on for a couple months, and had some very good results, but I wasn't able to use it consistently. After switching over to doctors up in northern Minnesota, I signed a form that said that I would not use medical marijuana, so for a year and a half I didn't, and my life went way back downhill. It was more than my wife could bear to see me wanting to die every day. It killed our marriage. I've tried everything from the physical therapy to ultrasound to electrostimulation, chiropractic, massage, acupuncture with electricity, aromatherapy, trigger point therapy, multiple nerve injections. I get spinal cord injections still every 3 months, counseling, biofeedback. My mother sent up something where I was supposed to speak with a doctor in northern Minnesota who was going to attach something to my ear that isn't approved yet. So I was going to meet him at his mother's. Last spring, I was found by a person who helped me out with marijuana. Since then, 7 of the last 9 months, I've been able to use it consistently. 4 times a day with my meds. I started sleeping 6 to 7 hours a night. When I would sleep straight, my arm wasn't moving. I would wake up in less pain. That would start the day out a little bit better. After a few days of that, the pain continued to get better. I was able to break the methadone pills in half. I was able to cut the fentanyl patches in half. So I wasn't having the horrible nausea. I wasn't having all the side effects from it once I was cutting things down. I was able to eliminate the stuff for the horrible heartburn that would accompany all the meds. Being able to not move my arm has been the best thing, and the marijuana allowed me to lay flat for many hours. I was even able to teach photography a little bit. I'm still not able to go and run after everything. I'm just going to let you guys pass this around. Oh, a little bit of entertainment, show and tell. Those pills that are going around right now, the rectangle ones are methadone, which is what they give heroin patients. The round ones are baclofen, a very powerful muscle relaxant. The red ones are amitriptyline, a powerful sleeping medication. And the clear patches that you see are the fentanyl, which taxpayers pay $67 per patch. That is 1 month of my medication that I did not have to take while being on while using medical marijuana four times a day. I was hoping for a glass. I was going to destroy that month's worth, like I destroyed some for law enforcement a couple of months ago. I don't want the meds. I don't want drugs. I just want my life back. I want to be able to get up and do things and be a productive member to society. I know I've got more surgery coming up, and I feel horrible. I hear the stories of the people who have died. I can't comprehend that. I also realize I'm not dying, so this is going to be this way. And it's not getting any better. And they don't know if the next surgeries are going to help or not. One thing before I close up, law enforcement has talked a lot of times about, they're worried about kids getting into the medicine cabinet. First, any of us that are up here who are dealing with this, the things in our medicine cabinet that are already there are much more dangerous. Actually, if I had marijuana with my medicine in the medicine cabinet and a kid got in there, hope to God they grabbed the marijuana so that they didn't die. Because one day of my medications would easily kill a kid if they took it at once. I'd like to ask you a question, a couple of quiet questions I don't want you to answer. First, how many, if you've seen a doctor in the last 2 years, second, did that doctor prescribe anything for you? If not, did they suggest surgery for you? Did they suggest chemo or radiation for a loved one? Did they suggest any other radical treatment? We trust our doctors with all of that. But yet, I don't understand why we just won't trust them to make a decision about marijuana in conjunction with the regular treatment. The hardest thing is we're not able to talk to our doctors safely. All we can ask is that you let our doctors make our decisions. More than anything, that's all we want, is to talk to our doctors. It's hard to understand why people who aren't doctors can make decisions on our minds, on our physical health. I just want to thank you for the time.
Thank you.
I'm last, please, to shut me up.
So,
I'm just here to be quiet. And I talk fast. Good afternoon. My name is Joni Whiting, and I appreciate the opportunity to tell my story. However, I want to be clear from the outset. There's nothing being done here in this room today that will benefit my family or me. There is nothing you can give to ease our pain. I will suffer the rest of my life for what I have lost. I am here today only to tell you about a woman that I loved and lost 6 years ago. I ask only that you listen to her story, to walk just briefly in her shoes and mine. My daughter Stephanie was a wife, a loving mother of three, and a beloved employee of Dart Distributing. Stephanie had a unique and beautiful voice, the voice of an angel. In June of 2000, at 24 years of age, Stephanie was diagnosed with melanoma skin cancer on her face. A mole had gone bad during her third pregnancy, and it was already too late. The next 2 years were filled with experimental therapies and endless surgeries as they cut her face off 1 inch at a time until there was nothing left to cut. There was nothing to put back to cover the hole in her face. All but four of her teeth had been removed due to the side effects of the chemotherapy, and the skin grafts had failed. It was difficult for her to eat. The nausea was so severe that the medications gave her little to no relief. A doctor at the hospital pulled me aside and told me that she may get some relief from smoking marijuana. But that wasn't an acceptable option for me or her being drug-free. In addition, the legal ramifications associated with illegal use were frightening. After her 10th surgery, all efforts to save her life had failed, and her oncologist predicted that she had about 6 months to live. At that time, she was taking approximately 40 to 50 tablets of Oxycontin and 30 to 40 tablets of Roxycodone per day. yet her pain was still evident in her every breath and in her every movement. Her whole body was racked with continuous and uncontrollable pain, and her tumors continued to grow. There was nothing to stop it, nothing even to slow it down, and the hope for a miracle faded as my child bravely began to make plans for the ending of her life. When Zofran, the anti-nausea drug, continued to give her no relief, Stephanie began to lose weight. We asked her doctor to prescribe Marinol, a synthetic version of THC, one of the active chemical compounds in marijuana. But even taking this in pill form didn't abate any of her symptoms, and she stopped taking it because it didn't work. As her tumors grew larger, it became more and more difficult for her to eat. They were growing inside and outside of her mouth, her throat, and her chest. My other adult children begged me to let her use marijuana, and when I refused, they took her out of my home. When she came back 3 days later, Stephanie told me that she'd gotten hungry after using it and that the marijuana had tipped up her appetite, as well as allowed her to keep the food down. She had eaten 3 meals a day at a time when she routinely ate nothing for days. She had just a touch of energy back, and she looked better than I had seen her in months. For reasons I don't know, the marijuana also enhanced the effects of Stephanie's pain medication and didn't make her appear high. My only regret is not allowing her to use marijuana in my home throughout her illness. Yet the fear of being caught was significant. I called a number of my family friends and asked if they knew of anywhere we could purchase marijuana. The next morning, someone had placed a package of it on our doorstep. I have never known whom to thank for it, but I remain grateful beyond belief. I was prepared to defend my daughter's use to anyone who asked. In retrospect, I can tell you with conviction I would have no problem going to jail for acquiring medical marijuana for my suffering child. The law is unjust, and I would rather spend the rest of my life in prison than have denied her the medicine that kept her pain at bay for 80 and allowed her, to live 89 more days. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, quote, "I submit that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the community, the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for the law," unquote. I am here today to tell you I am no longer willing to support making criminals out of the sick and dying. I saw with my own eyes that medical marijuana worked. I have dedicated a large portion of my own life to helping people stay clean and drug-free, and I see no contradiction in this at all. My daughter was able to eat for nearly 3 more months because of marijuana. I allowed her to use it in my home before meals because it worked and it helped her, and every day of her life was precious to her and her 3 small children. We had Thanksgiving and Christmas with her at the table that year. Having her there was priceless. Shortly after, Stephanie was placed on 24-hour nursing care and could no longer use medical marijuana. Her pain was so severe that when she asked my husband and me to lay down on both sides of her and hold her, she couldn't stand the pain of us touching her body. She was on IV morphine and moaned in pain continuously. Her hospice nurses were so disturbed by the severity of her pain that they finally used IV lidocaine to numb her body. The morphine, even at the strongest dose allowed by law, wasn't giving her any relief. On January 14, 2003, at 1:30 in the morning, with her beloved children sleeping in their beds in the other rooms. Stephanie died in the room she grew up in, holding my hand. Her strong heart continued to beat for nearly 3 minutes. She was 26 years old. They say there's no greater loss than that of a child for a parent. It is a right for this government to deny those who need medical marijuana to lessen the severity of their pain, nausea, and seizures is unjustifiable. To threaten the sick and dying and their loved ones with jail is unconscionable. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and my youngest son has recently returned from 18 months in Iraq. We are a family that honors this country, having served it in the military in every conflict since the Revolutionary War. I don't use drugs, and I don't abuse alcohol. I've raised 4 children. I'm currently raising the children my daughter had left behind. What would you have done had you been in my shoes? Could you sleep at night when your child is screaming in pain? What price would you really be willing to pay to relieve the suffering of someone you love? The fact is, you can't do anything for me, but there are other similar situations right now in Minnesota. They deserve compassion, dignity, and honor, and you can provide those people some amount of relief to them by passing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
I also have for you, they're not for the public. Is there such a page that if you could, like, there's 5 of them, and maybe one every 3 people or something. These are pictures of my daughter. And I want you to see that this isn't something that people use this and then they just go, have fun. You look at my daughter. The last picture you'll see is her Christmas picture, and the second one is her having Thanksgiving food. The first one is when she stole my shirt and went and had her pictures taken and then told me that she didn't borrow it, but I have proof on my first picture. I thank you very much.
Thanks for coming. Any questions on this? Thank you all for coming. And I think Mr. Steinberg submitted some written testimony is in your packet. I think we're running out of time here, so we're going to move on to the opponents of this. But thank you for submitting the written testimony. Professor Mosby, please come on down. And then Mr. Hoffitz will be next. Welcome to the committee. Welcome to the committee. Hi, please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Deborah Mosby. I'm an assistant professor at Metropolitan State University in the Human Services Department in the Alcohol and Drug Counseling major. Shall I begin?
Please, yeah.
Okay. Good afternoon. I felt very torn when I heard the stories previous to now because I had a mother who also died of cancer and who also smoked marijuana in her last year of life. However, in the last 4 years, I've been a professor teaching about what marijuana does for the brain and the body. And although I'd like to talk about other things, in fact, I'll just say the accessibility of tobacco and alcohol in our country is the foremost thing that influences adolescent youth. And the fact that kids can get tobacco and get alcohol very easily is what influences those drugs to be used more. Just last 5 years, we've heard lots about pharmaceutical meds and what's happening with adolescent use there. And the fact is, all of us are getting medicine cabinets full of pharmaceutical meds. It's real easy to go into some neighbor's house, open the cabinet, and get something. And my teenagers have come home and said, so-and-so was taking Vicodin because they had a headache. Oh, okay, so that's accessibility. I'm not going to talk about that. I would also like to point out I'm not going to talk about what's happened in the other states since legitimizing marijuana use, other than to say it's gone a little bit crazy and there's people going in with anxiety getting marijuana prescriptions, and marijuana actually raises your heart rate and raises your blood pressure and would possibly make you more anxious, even though it has a sort of a sedative effect. That's other states. We are here, and just because the other guys are jumping in the lake doesn't mean we have to. When I started being a drug counselor almost 20 years ago, I was thinking marijuana was just pot, because back in the 70s when I came up, it was 1% THC. THC is tetrahydrocannabinol. Nowadays it's 17 to 20%, and it's like the old hash or hash oil from the olden days. It's pretty strong. That's why they have one hitters, you know, just one hit can get you pretty high. It's a strong thing. THC is a fat soluble substance, and so when it goes into our body, it dissolves in our fatty organs. And the most fatty organs we have, of course, are our brain, which is the fattiest, it's like 30% fat, our liver, our reproductive organs, and our white blood cells. And so when we talk about smoking cigarettes, of course you have all the cancer-causing, I had a little thing I passed around, I'm not going to go into the details of that, but the cancer-causing materials in marijuana are pretty equitable to the ones that are in tobacco. And you can see that. There's all kinds of research out there about that. They're talking about using steamers and using other things, other means, eating marijuana. When you take marijuana into the system, even without the smoke, it goes in and it compromises certain organs. We've for 20 years had information that it affects people trying to get pregnant, you know, because it goes into the ovaries and the testes, and it lowers people's ability to be fertile. So we know that. We know in the brain that it takes 30 to 60 days to clear out of the brain. When it goes in there, it gets just sucked up into the brain and it stays there for a long time. The point of all this is blood cells are also fatty. White blood cells are what kill off germs. That's what, you know, our immune system is based on. And marijuana lowers immunity to other disease. When somebody has AIDS or lupus, where it compromises your immunity, if you smoke marijuana, it can lower even still your immunity to other diseases. Cancer, I would not take a joint out of the hand out of somebody who's dying. On the other hand, if they're fighting cancer and they want to live, we know for a fact that the carcinogens and these properties in marijuana are going to take down their resistance and maybe end their life sooner. I can understand, too, that's a hard weight to, you know, if somebody's suffering, do you want a month of more quality life, or do you want to, you know, not give them pots and let them last longer? That's a hard situation. But I guess I'm here to advocate for youth. I've been working with youth for 30 years. I don't want to see marijuana any more accessible. My kid brought home weeds, and so I sat down with him and said, okay, I'll watch weeds with you. And they have stores, they can go in, and all you have to do is get a script, and I know if I go to the doctor here, I can get a script for Vicodin, I can get a script for Ritalin if I'm ADD, and the way it's looking, doctors who have no background in addiction medicine are going to be passing out the scripts. And it's really easy right now for my kids to go and get Vicodin or Oxy or any of these Percodan, these kind of drugs. And I don't want that to happen. I'm saying my own kids, but for all the other kids I've worked with all these years. So basically, as you can tell, I'm opposing this bill. And I passed out some information. I have lots more to share if anybody would care to know. And at the end of that is my contact information in that little packet, too, if there's something that comes up at a later time, if you were interested. And I'd be happy to answer a question if you have any.
Any questions, Tim? Thank you. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is James Hapis.
And if Mr. Rasmussen would like to come make his way down as well, just welcome, though.
I'm here to testify against this bill because I know the dangers of marijuana from personal experience. For me, marijuana was an addictive, destructive gateway drug. This bill opens the door wide to abuse by individuals and will only increase health problems in society. I began smoking marijuana when I was 13. I became lethargic and melancholy by age 17 because I was smoking it every day. I blew the opportunity to go to the University of Minnesota on a hockey scholarship because of smoking pot and drinking. My grade point average went from a 3.8 to 2.3 as this party lifestyle took over. I'm 53 years old now and I'm in a one-year-long treatment program learning how to live life free from drugs and alcohol for the first time in many years. My drug problems all started with marijuana. I've known thousands of addicts throughout my life and not one of them began on cocaine or LSD or heroin or abusing prescription painkillers. All of them that I've gotten to know personally began by using marijuana. Pot is a gateway drug. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. I've been around drugs for 40 years, and I know that most people have started this way. This bill will send the wrong message to impressionable young people that there's nothing wrong with marijuana because now it's a medicine. Smoking marijuana is anything but a medicine. I can sympathize with people who have serious health issues. I've destroyed my own liver with drugs and alcohol. But in my opinion, legalizing smoked marijuana would open a door to health problems in more people's lives, which would far outweigh the benefits to individuals. There are many medications already on the market that are addressing the health problems that marijuana would address. In closing, this bill would put the health and well-being of far more people at risk than it would help. Thank you.
Thank you. Reverend Gottlieb, you wanted to... To all testifiers? Okay, that's fine. Thank you. Thank you for coming today. I appreciate it. Any questions for the witness? Mr. Rasmussen.
Chairman, committee, my name is Ryan Rasmussen. I grew up in Burnsville, and growing up, my parents smoked pot, very little amounts of it, and it grew into a larger amount, and pretty soon my parents got divorced over the behavior problems of what marijuana can do to people. I'd get babysat by my older uncle, and he'd bring me to his house, and when I'd go over there, I experimented by seeing large lights, fans, and green plants. By the eighth grade, I was growing marijuana. Growing in high school, I had problems with my sports and with learning academically, and that almost threw me out of high school, but thankfully, I graduated, and by growing marijuana, I know the potency of THC levels in the plant, and they only get higher, and I've seen tons of people take one hit and would sit down, lay down, they'd pass out just off the strong potency of the drug. I see that 2.5 ounces is a large amount. Being able to have on you that I could roll over 100 joints with 2.5 ounces. And over 12 plants, they say, well, one plant, I could get 3/4 of a pound, which is about 10 to 12 ounces in one plant. And I'd produce, out of 12 plants, I'd have a rotation of 3 times in a year. And by knowing these amounts, I was a first-hand grower, and it ruined my life. I'm in a treatment program. My learning ability is coming back slowly but surely. I'm able to read a chapter a little bit and kind of remember some of it, but what marijuana really did to me was affected my mind. It drew me into more drugs. I began carrying guns because I had plants and I was scared that people were going to come and rob me. I've seen other people do it firsthand, and I'd hate to see. I go into high schools now for a program, and I talk to youth, and I tell them the effects of what marijuana can do to you, and what other drugs, and how it is not safe. And I understand the medical purposes of it, but it can get really out of hand, and it's very addictive, and it can be very abusive easily. I just thank you for hearing me today.
Thank you very much for coming. Any questions? Okay, thank you. I'm going to have Ms. Wagner come up next. Nope, very good. Very good. Close by. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. My name is Sherry Wagner. I'm from southern Minnesota, and I drove up here today to tell you a story about my experience with cancer and drugs. I'm here to testify as a mother, a wife, and a daughter. I had a father-in-law die of colon cancer 10 years ago. He had 2.5 weeks to live. He died a very painful death. I had a husband who died 6 years ago, who was in the health profession. He died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He suffered for 2.5 years. And on January 22nd of this year, my father died after a 2.5 month battle with pancreatic cancer. So I know full well what cancer does to loved ones, and also I know what it does to a family. When I have 3 children, and when my husband was diagnosed with cancer, my children were very young. When Dale died, my youngest was 2.5. Hardly any memories of his father. The middle child, which was a daughter, was 9. She loved her father very dearly. And then my oldest, who was my son, was 16. His way of coping with his father's illness and death was marijuana. My husband was in the health profession. He did not agree that marijuana should be made legal. It should not be used in any purpose or form. When cancer happens to a family, this is a time for engagement with loved ones, acceptance in what lies ahead, finding clarity in the confusion where time is precious, how the patient copes with their diagnosis and illness is being viewed by loved ones who feel they want to help but don't know how, because all of the emotions and dynamics and personalities that come into play during the illness and the treatment hurt everyone. This should be a time of reflection, healing, seeking forgiveness, peace with others, resolving issues, questions and answers, not only by the person who is diagnosed with the cancer, but by the loved ones who are watching this person suffer and die. They're going to have good days. They're going to have bad days. I saw my loved ones on the good days, and I held their hand, and I gave them words of comfort on the bad days. Most recently, my father, he was a man with a lot of dignity, but he also said that, Sherry, it's not day by day, it's not hour by hour, it's not minute by minute, but it's second by second. He was dealing with it second by second. And during those times, He interacted with his family. He talked to his 7 children. He talked to his siblings. He had closure. And my understanding with medical marijuana, if you were to legalize it, some of the things that were brought up that I agree with, because I've seen it firsthand with my son, who is now 21, almost 22 years old. His life was by no fault of his own, but because he was trying to cope with losing a father who was his best friend and his mentor. He lost a scholarship to a university for baseball. He went further, delved further into drugs, not only marijuana, but cocaine and other drugs. I didn't find that out until he called me one day from school. I knew that there were problems, and we went to counseling, but he had shut himself off from family members. He didn't want them to know the depth of his pain and his addiction problem. And he called me one day at work, and he said, "Mom, I need help." This was on his father's birthday, after his father had died. And he said, "Mom, I need help. Will you come and get me? I can't do this anymore." And he said an expletive, and he said, "I'm sick and tired of doing this. I need help. Will you come and get me?" Of course, I left my work. I went and got my son, and I took him to Hazleton. And he's still trying to get his life back together. He's not in school. Because of the addiction problem, he committed some crimes. He stole my car twice. I had to file charges against him because I knew that if I didn't step up to the plate and do something to help my son and let him know the difference between right and wrong, that he was going to keep making mistakes. Marijuana, this is according to the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and this is their policy position, and you can go to their website and get this, but it says, "Marijuana is an addictive drug that poses significant health consequences to its users, including those who may be using it for medical purposes. Marijuana has been proven to be a psychologically addictive drug. Scientists at the National Institute of Drug Abuse have demonstrated that laboratory animals will self-administer THC in doses equivalent to those used by humans who smoke marijuana. Persons using marijuana, even for medicinal purposes, suffer withdrawal symptoms when use is stopped, such as restlessness, loss of appetite, trouble with sleeping, weight loss, and shaky hands. The short-term effects of marijuana use include memory loss, distorted perception, trouble with thinking and problem-solving, loss of motor skills, decrease in muscle strength, increased heart rate, and anxiety." I can go on and on. What I'm trying to say is I experienced all of that with my family members who had cancer. Marijuana will just compound it. It's not helping the problem. It's covering up. I would have rather had my family members able to converse with other family members instead of being medicated with a drug that you know is going to alter their thinking. And they're not going to be in the room. They're not going to be in the picture. I know that because I saw firsthand from my son from age 16 to 21. Actually, it happened before he was 16. When he was 16.
If you could wrap up a little quickly so we can get to the other testifiers. But thank you.
I thank you very much. I draw inspiration from my family members who went through the process. I appreciate the fact that I was able to hold their hand and comfort them, and I'm glad that they drew near to the Lord in their time of trouble instead of coping with a drug that covers up the problem. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Mr. Frayling and Mr. Pritchard, if you want to both come down. And we're going to go for another 10 minutes here, members, because there's not a committee following it today. So, caucus.
Yeah.
Which.
Yeah.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
My name is James Ring. I'm 37 years old from St. Paul. I oppose this bill because of the health dangers it proposes. the dangers it poses to individuals and society. Marijuana is a dangerous drug. It's mind-altering drug, so it impairs a person's judgment. It's extremely addictive. It's a gateway drug to other drugs. If pot isn't addictive, then why are our drug treatment programs filled with thousands of kids trying to kick pot? And I'm going to put adults in there too, because I'm in a year-long treatment program too. I started using drugs when I was 12 years old, when my sister introduced me to marijuana. I smoked weed for a number of years every day. I started selling marijuana when I was 13 to other kids. I'll just continue through my junior and senior high school years. The use of marijuana took a toll on my grades. Before I started using marijuana, I had very good grades. After I started smoking it, my grades fell to the point where I barely passed high school and my college dreams were all but gone. I tried quitting smoking marijuana numerous times throughout the year with no luck. After a while, I started using stronger drugs like meth, cocaine, you name it. I pretty much tried them all. All of them I said I would never use. Over the next 23 years, I used and sold a lot of drugs, marijuana being a major part of that. I currently have three first-degree narcotic sales on my record. I've been in a year-long treatment program for 11 months. I was sentenced to treatment instead of going to prison for 20 years. I've already served a 90-month sentence for drug sales, so I have a lot of experience in the illegal drug trade. From what I know, I firmly believe this bill will put the public safety and health at risk. When I heard this proposal, my criminal mind started turning. I see it this way from the perspective of a former marijuana and drug dealer.
And we first, do want to focus on the medical aspects as opposed to there's going to be other committees that deal with the criminal and the criminal justice aspects of the bill.
Okay. So. Basically, I guess what I try to sum it up is from a health aspect, I mean, there's going to be crimes committed that people are going to get hurt over the money that's involved with this marijuana. And I'll just leave it at that, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Pritchard.
Yes, Tom Pritchard, President of the Family Council.
And Mr. Franklin wants to come down. But go ahead. Thank you. Sorry.
Yeah, and I just want to say we don't oppose the medically prescribed use of marijuana, but we do oppose efforts to circumvent the drug approval process. We have a number of concerns with this bill. It will put the individual and society's health at risk. First of all, this is not a tightly crafted bill and will open the door to significant abuse which far outweighs any benefits. First, look at the definition of who's eligible to receive medical marijuana. It ultimately can be given to anyone who experiences pain for over 6 months, Section 2, Subdivision 2. This could be a tennis elbow, a sore hip, a bad knee, or any other number of associated pains which could easily be addressed by Tylenol. The fact that this was open to abuse is all you have to do is look at other states. California, only 2% of the people there using marijuana for medical purposes are using it for cancer, AIDS, or glaucoma. In Colorado, it's only 8%. So the vast majority are not these severe situations. Another concern, there's no direction on how to use the drug. There's no directions on effectiveness, risk, dosage, interaction with other drugs, impact on pre-existing conditions, alternatives. None of that you're going to get with marijuana. In fact, they allow individuals to carry up to 2.5 ounces, which is the equivalent of about 150 joints. And there was previous testimony saying that all you needed was two puffs to relieve the pain in that person's situation. But here we're going to allow 150 joints to be carried on an individual's person. We're concerned the fact that this is not safe and isn't approved by the medical community. American Medical Association, American Cancer Society, American Academy of Pediatrics, the National Multiple Sclerosis Society all do not support the medical use of smoked marijuana. This will put the public's health at risk, and it's ripe for abuse. This bill will allow 18-year-old boys to grow marijuana in their homes. It'll prohibit landlords from regulating the growth and use of marijuana in their premises, from my reading of the bill. And finally, it sends the wrong message to our young people. It'll put them at risk. They'll be seeing people smoking marijuana. This can be dispensed under the bill in neighborhoods on main streets and neighborhoods and apartment buildings. And what's that going to communicate to young people? We're going to be told on the one hand that a marijuana is an addictive, dangerous drug, but now it's a medicine. In fact, as was stated, one study found that of 182,000 children in a treatment, 48% were admitted for abuse or addiction to marijuana, only 19% for alcohol. Finally, this legislation won't be limited to a few hundred individuals. In Colorado, a state comparable to Minnesota, which has medical marijuana, they have nearly 5,000 medical marijuana users. That translates into 60,000 legally grown marijuana plants, producing millions of joints of marijuana. I believe this bill will open up a can of worms, and I urge you to reject it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. So both Mr. Franklin and Mr. Prokopowicz, is that right?
Prokopowicz,
okay. And again, we're focusing on the health ad, but I understand you wanted to put something on the record.
Mr. Chairman. Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. We do have a letter and a handout here for you. We're representing the Law Enforcement Coalition of Minnesota County Attorneys, Police Chiefs, Sheriffs, Narcotics Officers Association. I'll try to be very brief. Today's testimony is obviously very emotional. There isn't one of us here that hasn't had a loved one that's been in these positions. I can testify personally to personal experience, both past and ongoing, and I know what has been testified to here today is very real. Secondly, one of our major concerns that we have is that this drug, marijuana, is illegal. It's not approved by the FDA. It's not approved, and that's one of our major objections. It will increase some criminal activity. I have a deputy right now with two bullet holes in him from a 7-Eleven shooting this morning that's fighting for his life in Fargo Hospital trying to stay alive. This is a result of criminal activity that's associated with unfortunately, drug, alcohol-related offenses. It's part of what we do. We're the thin blue line between chaos and orderly society. And we walk that very carefully, very proud, and we try to work these issues as carefully as we can. We have a number of issues here with the bill. We will not discuss those today. We will not talk about today the issues of other states. But I want to just simply focus on we in law enforcement find ourselves in a very difficult dilemma. On the one hand, we're human beings. We are protect and serve our mankind. At the same time, we uphold the law. Our fight, your fight, is not with us. It's with the FDA. You need to be looking at that issue and getting that approved. The fight should not be here. We law enforcement have to uphold the law. If we don't obey the federal law, can we pick and choose which laws we want to obey? We go after ethics training with our officers, and if we allow them to obey or disobey one law, what happens to our society? Can we pick and choose? It affects our working relationships with our state, our federal, and other federal partners as we do investigations. So we have very deep concerns about how this affects us, both from a law enforcement community as well as a health community that affects all of us as we serve you and try and maintain law and order. Thank you.
My name is Bill Prokopowicz. I'm the Chief Deputy Dakota County Attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. At the outset, I would share my comments on my colleagues regarding sympathy our members have and our association for those suffering from serious illnesses and medical conditions that were testified to here today. As indicated previously, we do also have family members and close friends that have suffered from similar conditions and the painful effects from those illnesses. That being said, as county attorneys and assistant county attorneys on a daily basis, we experience in our courtrooms the other side and the other effects regarding marijuana use and chemical abuse, much of which has already been testified here to today, and I won't go into it. And for this primary reason, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association continues to oppose this particular legislation. The association and the coalition asked this committee to be mindful that the FDA and the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy have specifically classified marijuana as a Schedule I controlled substance. The definition of that under the Minnesota statute is a high potential for abuse, no current acceptable medical use in the United States, a lack of accepted safety for use under medical supervision. And you've heard testimony regarding the effects of multiple marijuana use. The only additional thing that I would point out to that testimony, in addition to the 2.5 ounces, the current legislation would allow an individual to also cultivate up to 12 marijuana plants unless he lives within 5 miles of a registered organization. studies conservatively estimate that a half pound to a pound can be harvested from a marijuana plant. That's in the course of a year, 6 to 12 pounds of marijuana that would be used.
And we had a specifier that covered that.
That's clearly in excess of the amount reasonably necessary, which only leaves the opportunity for abuse. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize we haven't left a lot of time for talking about the bill itself, but let me be brief. I lost 4 relatives to cancer, 2 of the very painful forms of cancer, so I get that. We need to focus on this bill, and this bill, as crafted, is not tightly crafted. The people who testified here, my heart goes out to you, but this bill does not limit the use of medical marijuana to those conditions. It is much, much broader, and so that is a deep concern, and it isn't a disrespect to anything that you've been through. I also want to point out to the members of the committee, especially those who weren't through this debate the last time it came around through the legislature, the Food and Drug Administration has a process, and this goes directly to health care policy. Numerous federal HHS divisions, agencies have reviewed medical marijuana. It has gone through scientific studies. They have concluded that no sound scientific study supported medical use of marijuana for treatment in the United States, and no animal or human data supported the safety or efficacy of marijuana for general medical use. Efforts that seek to bypass the FDA drug approval process would not serve the interests of public health because they might expose patients to unsafe and ineffective drug products. FDA has not approved smoked marijuana for any condition or disease indication. If we want this to happen, if we believe that it's effective even for very limited uses in cases of extreme pain in hospice situations, then it ought to go through the FDA process. And furthermore, I mean, the bill itself, as it's currently written, no mention of efficacy, no mention of potency. Are we talking about Minnesota Green, Acapulco Gold, Maui Wowie? I know that sounds like a joke, but I'm dead serious. What species are we talking about? What is the potency? What is it going to deliver when you smoke 1.5 ounces of this stuff? Okay? Allowed amounts gets referred to several times in this bill. There is no definition, especially for these organizations, of what an allowed amount is. It gets referred to several times, but if you read the bill, there's really no way to determine how much they're allowed to hang on to and how much they're not allowed to hang on to. It says other parts of marijuana plants, but it doesn't refer to what other refers to. And then the entire FDA process. And I know we don't have a lot of time to talk about the rest of the bill, but perhaps Representative Rukavina can respond to some of these issues.
Representative Rukavina.
Chair.
Very briefly.
Briefly, Mr. Chair and members, I have files and files and books upstairs of different medical organizations that give the exact opposite opinion of you as for the medical benefits of marijuana regarding the officers talking about the Drug Enforcement Administration. You know, in 1972, a petition was submitted to the Drug Enforcement Administration.
And we don't want to get off into law enforcement right. thing. But
that whole issue was addressed. The Chief Administrative Law Judge, and I quote, his ruling, marijuana in its natural form is one of the safest therapeutically active substances known, and recommended its transfer to Schedule II, and the DEA just, you know, rejected it. So, you know, that route is not an easy one. As far as the other states members, I can give you statistics. You heard numbers of people in other states on the drug. In some of those states, it was done, in many of them, by initiative, and there wasn't the controls that there are in this bill. New Mexico, which is a state similar to ours, there's 206 registered patients right now. That bill was passed in 2007. And let me see if I can pick up another one. Colorado, yes, passed in 2004,819. That is one patient per 1,000, one person per 1,000 patients. Members, I'm sad to listen to the stories of the gentlemen that came down regarding the gentlemen that came down regarding the addictive measures. It had nothing to do with medical marijuana, and that's what this bill has to do with. So, members, again, today I hope your vote is an important step towards protecting seriously ill Minnesotans. And I've got for every statistic that can be shown the clear evidence that the, and I think the testimony proves that, that some patients who help, who suffer from terrible diseases get help from this drug, and, you know, they shouldn't have to get arrested or go to jail for it. And as far as the Food and Drug Administration, President Gottlieb, they've done a hell of a good job lately. They can't even manage peanut butter. I've got, you know, Embro here. Let's see the cases of Embro, which is a psoriasis drug that it can cause bruising, easily
and
bruising,
and death. We do have to wrap up now.
Go through all of these about the FDA. So, members, you've heard the testimony. I'd appreciate your support.
Representative,
moving it on to other.
Emmer has requested a roll call, so the clerk will take the roll.
Yes.
Keeson.
Yes.
Abler.
No.
Bunn.
No.
Emmer.
No.
Fritz. Gardner.
Yes.
Gottwald.
No.
Hayden.
Yes.
Huntley.
Yes.
Kelly.
No.
Lane.
Yes.
Liebling.
Yes.
Loeffler.
Yes.
Mack.
No.
Murphy.
Yes.
Norton. Rude. Tao.
Yes.
Torkelson.
It's 9 ayes, 6 nays. The bill passes. I did renew my motion before, so as amended, and is referred to civil justice.
Civil justice.
Thank you, members. And we're bill passes. We're adjourned.